Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia, in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. This is episode 51. We call it Imagine Energy. Back in November of 2018, I attended the Geography 2050, Powering Our Future Planet conference in New York City. Big question in my mind was, who is imagining the energy landscapes of the future? How are they doing it? Where and in what spaces? I met Elizabeth Monoyan and Robert Ferry, a designer and architect who co-founded the Land Art Generator Initiative, bringing a mix of art, pedagogy, politics, and community development. They work in an interdisciplinary mode with the goal of imaginative collaboration. The Land Art Generator Initiative, or LAGI, is harnessing the power to reshape 21st century energy landscapes. Joining us on the phone today are Elizabeth and Robert from Seattle. Let's start with how they got started with LAGI.
We moved to Dubai in August of 2008, and it was in October of that year that we sat down and brainstormed the idea of the Land Art Generator Initiative. And it was always our thought from the first brainstorm that it would be an interdisciplinary project. It was and remains important to us that we are always engaging groups of creatives. They could be landscape architects, artists, designers, working alongside engineers and scientists.
Yeah, in collaborative teams, so to speak, right?
It's always a collaborative effort, all projects and outcomes. And we have teams who submit to our competitions that might be two people or might be 12 to 15 people working together. And we really appreciate that. And we truly believe that that's where real change will come from, needs to come from.
Yeah, the paradigm of the mid-20th century large-scale engineering projects, the most obvious example would be the paving of the Los Angeles River. Right. That lack of interdisciplinarity and creativity in the process of design for infrastructures is something that we really do need to move beyond, and it's only with those kind of large teams that that's possible.
Yeah. Is this, so the genesis of the project you kind of locate in Dubai, is that funny to you at all that it's the center of oil wealth, these new ideas about the future of energy and what that's going to look like on the landscape, that they're coming from there? Is that at all? I don't know.
Well, it's such an interesting question, and there is a really great quote that I'm not going to get exact. Sheikh Mohammed Maktoum's father said, that he drove a Mercedes, something like this. He drove a Mercedes.
His
father rode a camel. He drove a Mercedes. His son drove a Range Rover. And that, in a generation or so ago, or coming, that it would again be back to the camel. So it was really this... wisdom around the limited resource of oil.
Yeah.
The rulers the UAE, Abu Dhabi, and Dubai, especially as far as we're aware, are very cognizant of the temporal nature of the petroleum economy and the need to diversify. We were also fascinated to learn about the history of land art in the UAE and a lot of artists working in the land as their canvas for creativity. And so there's a very complex relationship to the oil economy, and it's brought great benefits to the people as a public good. At the same time, it's something that is fleeting, and that's very much in the minds of those who live there. They're very used to and have a historical relationship to boom and bust economies. They've experienced something similar at the beginning of the 20th century with the pearling economy in the same region. Things come and go, and that's something that they're very well aware of.
Yeah, so in some ways we should take it as they're signaling to the rest of the world that this is serious. We're moving on beyond petroleum. And if they're doing that, then perhaps we should take it much more seriously than we are. Is that one way of thinking about this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's very complicated. There's no simple answer. So it's difficult from the perspective of a high carbon country like the United States, whose greatness is very much owed to a long history of exploitation of natural resources, to come from that perspective and tell countries who have a shorter history with that they need to keep the carbon in the ground. And we need to be a leader in pointing the pathway to prosperity that comes in a post-carbon economy. And so I think it's really incumbent upon the United States and Europe and the rest of the world who has created the vast historic bubble of carbon emissions in our atmosphere to take a leadership role and point the way.
Yeah. And you mentioned I'm still picturing this, the moment. I guess I like to think of moments when these ideas kind of come together. In Dubai, you're also seeing land art happening maybe in a different sort of, and having a different history there than in the U.S., especially maybe the American West. These ideas are coming together, and you're seeing then this space to bring maybe more the popular imagination of energy landscapes. I don't know, to really challenge that? Is that what's happening? You see the space to do some work in between how everyday people are thinking about energy futures and how the big business is thinking about that future.
Well, let me just back up a little bit more to where you started. That question was about the sort of painting the picture of what the landscape was like in Dubai at that time.
Yeah.
We were there from 2008, 2012. And it was just a couple of years before that Art Dubai had started, which is an international art fair. Galleries started popping up all around Dubai. And there was this creative vibration that was very exciting in the UAE. It continues. Some of the best art I have seen, contemporary art, is coming out of the Middle East and on view right there in the UAE. And then at the same time, it was a landscape of building faster and bigger and ambitious. And when we lived there, that vibration was an infusion. We had the sense that we could do something bigger and bolder and wilder, and that somehow we could dream big in the UAE, specifically in Dubai. And I think that was and continues to be why people flood that area. It's a space on this planet where you can go and you can imagine and you can realize what's in your imagination. So that was how we founded the Land Art Generator Initiative.
Yeah.
Was at a very exciting moment with a landscape that, you know, the literal landscape of the deserts and the water and the sunshine and, all of those resources, natural resources. But then just, it was a very exciting place to live. And we imagined something, and in fact, we were able to realize it by living there. And I don't think it would have, that Lavi would have been successful had we founded it, say, in Pittsburgh, which is where we had moved from.
Yeah.
We also brought with us our passion around the genre of land art as it evolved in the 60s and 70s in the United States, Southwest especially. And projects like Walter de Maria's Lightning Field, were definitely at the front of our minds, because we were seeing the opportunity for new energy landscapes to be something more than just the utilitarian aesthetic of the engineering that goes into them. Although, to say that, one of the most inspiring things in the genesis of the project were these large solar power tower installations that were springing up at that time, which we saw as almost unintentional works of land art.
Yeah.
All these mirrors, thousands of mirrors in the landscape, focusing sunbeams through the sky. And so I think that all of that came together to point to an opportunity for certain places where destination artworks could be a valuable social good at the same time as they were functionally providing clean electricity to power hundreds or even thousands of homes. You know, recognizing that we're not going to power the entire world with art, but art has the power to inspire the minds of the world. And great art movements throughout history have had the ability to push culture in ways that have been good and bad, but that the opportunity for artists to play an active role is really strong at this time.
I guess for the listener, is this, I'd hate to reduce everything you're doing to one sort of equation, but is that the core of it, is to be designing? So you're looking at, you have your own projects, but you're also trying to get people to kind of engage with this process and submit their ideas for different land art energy projects. It's about designing land art that also has a function and also functions as electricity generation or as an electricity generator in some cases or in many cases. And not just for, you know, I guess to put a little bit of the scale on here, not just for two houses, but you're looking at bigger scale energy production through these projects. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Although that was absolutely the founding idea in 2008. And since then, we've also been working at smaller scales, and we love that opportunity as well. But really, it's a way to provide the creative community with the knowledge that they can use renewable energy technologies as the media for their creative expression.
And, of course, we go well outside of the area of the creative community. You know, we engage in communities around the world, hands-on in neighborhoods, helping communities think through how they can design their own energy landscapes for their neighborhood, for their parks, you know, for their homes. So we work on a wide range of scales. Like Robert said, it could be residential scale or, you know, 10 to 20 to hundreds of homes.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Are there any projects that you think like really sort of illustrate what you've done, where you think you're going? There's one that's interesting to me. Just I grew up in Connecticut, and so I was looking through your work, the Willimantic Project. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. I'll start by talking about our international competitions to get to that. So since 2010, we've been holding biannual design competitions that are open to the world. So started in Dubai, then we went to New York City's Fresh Kills Park, then Copenhagen, then Santa Monica, off from the Santa Monica Pier, and then last year we were in Melbourne, Australia. Since then, it's become an annual competition, and this year we're back in the UAE. So, you know, those competitions are open, they're free, anyone around the world can participate. Logging Willimantic in Connecticut is a slightly different model.
Okay.
That was an invited competition. So we worked closely with the community to define a way to work that made sense for that community rather than coming in with an international competition. So it was Connecticut creatives and engineers who were invited to work on that project.
It was really boosted by support from the state of Connecticut, Department of Economic and Community Development, and a partnership with the Eastern Connecticut State University. And, of course, the primary partner, the landowner, the Willimantic Whitewater Partnership. And they have a great vision to turn this very important property in the heart of Willimantic into a public amenity focused on taking advantage of the resource of the Willimantic River and its potential for recreation and whitewater kayaking and rafting, but also to be an emblematic place for, as a destination, to declare a commitment to a sustainable future.
Yeah.
And so they latched on to the idea of holding that invited competition for Connecticut creative teams. Three teams were brought forward from a request for qualifications process.
Uh-huh.
And the winner, Peary Associates and team, came up with the design of Rio Illuminato, which is this beautiful curving arch capped with solar panels on its top surface and a reflective surface that is engaging to the public. And a water feature that tells the story of the natural, the ecosystem of the river and the history of the site. And it's just a beautiful, simple gesture in the land. It generates more than enough energy to make the park design itself net zero.
Yeah.
And the goal would be that it would serve as a catalyst for further economic development in the region.
Yeah, I mean, Willimantic itself, I just remember, I think, I go to this example, maybe it's not the most, maybe it doesn't illustrate all of your work the best, but I know this place, and so that's why I wanted to ask. Willimantic has had economic problems for decades, losing, it's an old mill town, if I remember, right? And using the
right,
river,
right.
Using the river, like many rivers in the Northeast, for mills. I can remember I went to university just up the hill there in Storrs, and going into Willimantic was sort of, it wasn't a destination. Let me just put it that way. And I think that's changing. And is this part of the sort of, the reshaping of downtown Willimantic? And it is, like you're saying, trying to maybe tell the story of the river in a different way, bringing people back into the city.
You bring up the historic use of the kinetic energy of flowing water and gravity energy. That's the fundamental to the history of the town and many around there. And the Willimantic is already on the upswing, but it has gone through rough times. And I think it's that that upswing energy that the community is looking to capitalize on and create a good path to a sustainable future for the economy and in harmony with nature.
You mentioned Pittsburgh before. Is Willimantic, I mean, they're different size cities with different industrial histories, but are some of the processes the same as maybe early 1990s Pittsburgh or all of 1990s Pittsburgh and into the early 2000s and sort of I don't know, people moving back into the city after losing?
Yeah,
very much in Pittsburgh. I moved to Pittsburgh in 97 for graduate school and was there for a couple of decades. And during those decades, saw a dramatic shift in, when I got there, it was a town where perhaps you went to university but then left immediately after. But that's not the case anymore. It's the place where young people move to start careers and families and stay after their higher ed. So it's got a vibrant, creative realm, affordable housing.
A very strong tech sector, healthcare sector, universities. So the diversified backbone of the economy and the strong local foundations have sort of righted the ship through the 80s and 90s rough patches. And like many post-industrial cities of the East and Midwest, it's coming back around in a really good way. And I think that is a good context within which to talk a little bit more about, you know, community energy and the power of that kind of distributed energy microgrids evolving for cities like that, where that can be its own economic driver. It's a really, I think that, you know, a lot of talk right now with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the resurgence of the idea of a Green New Deal and how that itself can be a job growth, a job creator for America, and really set an example so that you can create the great energy transition successfully at the same time as you're solving some of the critical pressing issues with regard to inequality and social justice and economics.
In the essay Powering Places, you mention a Sustainable Works Progress Administration, an SWPA, which is this the same thing that you're just talking about now with like this idea of a Green New Deal?
Absolutely. I think that's been in the zeitgeist for a while now, going back into the early 2000s, certainly. But we see a real opportunity now with failing infrastructure of the United States, and does that present an opportunity? And we think that it absolutely does. If you think about a 21st century effort that's on the scale of the WPA, which itself defines the American landscape of the 20th century,
right,
and laid such a strong foundation for economic expansion and prosperity, you know, at that time, the value of artists in the process was valued so highly that more than 15,000 artists were commissioned to produce work during that time, and basically paid a living wage by the federal government to do so. And now their art enlivens our cities and to this provides places like destinations like the Hoover Dam, where that Art Deco art that's incorporated into that infrastructure is the thing that people go there to see, not just to see a hydroelectric power plant, but to think of the 21st century version of that, creating monuments to this important time in human history, the great energy transition, that future generations will be able to come and visit and appreciate the creativity and the culture that existed at that time and celebrate it.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program or radio essay expedition that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world.
It's taking an idea that's very much, I mean, it's very American, right? This idea that everyone pitched in and people that were put to work coming out of the sort of the alphabet soup of the New Deal were put to work to create, well, let's just say to create. I'm even thinking of like the photography, sort of the photographers going around the country and documenting the Dust Bowl out in Oklahoma. This was a moment that, I mean, I teach history and geography, so we talk about it a lot, but I think it's a moment that's, I don't know, we think of it like we think of certain people as being American treasures. This is sort of a treasure in a lot of people's minds when the ship was righted, maybe, coming out of global economic crisis, which is very similar to, you know, the moment we're talking about now. You're in Dubai in 2008. I mean, it's in the midst of a global economic crisis that, you know, I guess to get back to this idea of the infrastructure in the U.S., like, is there money to pay for the big engineering style infrastructure, or is this a way to look forward? What do you think about that? I'm just repeating what you're saying, but.
Oh, no, not at all. It's an interesting framing. The idea of cost. So if the ability was there after the Great Depression to make that public investment in our infrastructure, then we have that today.
Yeah.
It's a lack of imagination to think that we cannot afford to create the infrastructures that we need to have a successful and prosperous future. We don't think, oh, well, how much will it cost when we put the great highway system across the United States under the Eisenhower administration? We didn't think, oh, well, how much will that cost when we thought about putting a man on the moon? But why is it that we often start naysaying about how much will it cost when we think about creating a sustainable energy grid and system, the power of the future economy of the United States? Is this very short-sighted? And the capital exists, and the mechanisms to generate that definitely exist. It's just a matter of will and doing it.
Will and the ability to imagine it too, right? I mean, isn't that?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so your work is sort of is instigating, is pushing, is encouraging, is soliciting. It's maybe even trying to crowdsource and harness some of that energy really around the globe to rethink and offer up a different proposal for the future that incorporates this sort of collaborative team spirit in a way that's maybe challenging the engineering paradigm.
Absolutely, and to get back to the idea of cost, it's really about investment in the future. And
yeah.
I think that we understood that better as a culture 100 years ago. And the time horizon has been becoming shorter and shorter. And investments have to pay back in 2 years now, or they're not worth it in the private sector. And it's sort of slanted our perspective on how public dollars can be invested and the payback that comes with that over decades, generations.
Wow. Yeah, so
far outweighs the current cost, yeah.
So the individual who used to buy savings bonds and would sit on it for 25 to 50 years.
Right, yeah.
Governments are also sort of have changed that horizon, the time horizon. They're looking for quicker kind of results.
And I think that considering infrastructure within the realm of public art, or finding ways to fuse the two, also changes the way that you think about investment. And we've, I think, thought about the work that we do at the Land Art Generator Initiative as a way to provide greater than the sum of its parts perspectives on investment. So if you are a city that already is, or if you're a developer that's already planning on putting 1% or 2% for the arts in a development, and you already have an idea that you want to have some component of on-site energy generation from renewables, if you can do both of those at the same time, you can, in fact, actually find ways to be more efficient with your upfront capital costs and accomplish both at once, and in the same time, create innovations within how renewable energy is implemented and how these new technologies can engage with the public.
Yeah, so is it this idea you mentioned in the essay, the same essay, Powering Place, Maya Lin, who said, save two birds with one tree? I mean, is this kind of idea that you could accomplish both things, and that's the kind of thinking that we need to solve energy issues moving forward?
There's always going to be a place for utilitarian renewable energy infrastructure, and there will always be a place for art that is not regenerative, but is seeking to accomplish other goals, and important ones at that. But there's also a space where there's an opportunity to unite those two worlds in a way that can create good that we can't even imagine.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition.
Where do you see this conversation, the conversation about energy futures? Because, you know, we met at a conference, and an interesting conference because it had a wide range of actors in this whole, or actors in the network of, energy use change or energy, the energy landscape and what it's going to look like in the next 50 years by 2050, according to the theme of the conference. Where are the conference itself, not this particular one, I mean this sort of with the capital C that could happen anywhere around the world, is that a place where the ideas are being generated about where to go next? Or do you see, and so at the conference we're looking at people who are writing about this, people who are speaking about it, doing research about it, who own companies that do things related to energy. I mean, is that where the change is going to happen? Or like with Loggy, it seems you're trying to democratize the what I'm calling the crowdsourcing, and you're trying to bring together creative energy and focus it in on a very, very important issue. By doing so, are you trying to widen the number of actors that are involved in making decisions about energy futures?
Yes, we are. And I think crowdsourcing is an appropriate term for our competition.
Okay.
Currently.
Yeah,
bringing people together through a platform, with everyone working on the same challenge. I would say that we've been crowdsourcing for the last decade. But in addition to that, you know, trying to reach communities of all demographics, you know, we really love working with young people for this reason, because we know that it's not too long before they're at the helm of decision-making or designing our energy landscape, because they are working at tech companies such as Siemens, or, you know, working in policy and making decisions for their community and their neighborhood, or, you know, maybe on a federal level. So it is really important that this conversation reach, yes, the types of conferences where we met you. We have great conversations and great outcomes,
yeah.
But it's equally important to get out of a group of people who already have, a platform of understanding and reach those who perhaps don't.
You're trying to reach people who maybe haven't really considered much about this, and you're introducing the idea to them to, I mean, is that... Or...
Yeah, the workshops that we do with communities, like the Art and Energy Camp that we held with an outcome of a constructed solar sculpture, it's a way to get, you know, people come off the street when you're building, and they want to talk to you about what they know about solar. And you know, as much as it's important at this time, while we're struggling with how we're going to turn the tide of carbon emissions, there are still many people who don't have an awareness of where their electricity comes from beyond the switch on the wall. And there's a really great opportunity for engagement through the arts and through creativity to really get people to start thinking more about that. But, you know, most importantly, bring influencers to the table. It's going to have to be all hands on deck.
Yeah.
Grassroots efforts, communities, cities, companies, many of which are leading the way in diversifying their energy portfolios. And of course, at the end of the day, we really do require leadership at the top, and hopefully that will come soon to meet everyone coming from down and from the bottom. And we need everyone everywhere doing what they can. We certainly can't rely on the individual consumer to make the right decisions for the environment anymore. But we need large, influential corporations, influential cultural figures. It has to become more at the front of popular culture, this whole change that's happening around us.
Yeah. So designing, we always say there's the NIMBY phenomena, not in my backyard, but by designing these, the yes in my backyard, I guess, designing these technologies and these and the art installations or sculptures, energy sculptures in someone's backyard, is this helping then demystify like where our energy comes from? I mean, is that part of the education process that, like our food production, we're also detached from where our energy comes from?
So through information graphics, through workshops, through outreach, wherever we can, we try and stress the information. And hopefully through engaging communities in the design of their own energy landscapes, you give the public a sense of agency in the solution, and that gets them excited, because it's one thing to be a bystander as change happens around you, but if you can be and feel that you have a role to play in that change, then we can increase the momentum behind the change.
Right. So your Art Plus Energy Camp in Pittsburgh, what were some outcomes of that? People feeling empowered by being a part of it and sort of feeling that sense of agency?
Certainly. It was a 6-week camp where we engaged around 15 or 16 young people aged 8 to 17.
Yeah.
In the Homewood neighborhood of Pittsburgh. And the programming was quite broad. We took them through you know, nice range of STEAM programming. We took them on field trips. They visited a coal-fired plant. They visited a nuclear plant.
Yeah.
And then we offset that with sustainable installations. And the kids had so many great questions. And we drove home on the bus. They really wanted to know about the facilities we had visited and the impact, and had very insightful questions. And that's how we started the camp. And those questions they had and what they witnessed carried them through to developing a sculpture for their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then as they were building that and out on site every day for the last couple of weeks, neighbors were coming and chatting with them, and they were able to share their information and what they had learned. And, you know, we were, the results blew us away. We didn't really know what to anticipate except for a built outcome. We didn't understand all of the nuances of conversations throughout the course of the summer.
It's a good point to talk about how the relative value of community solar installations is affected by how much they engage the communities in which they are placed. So there's two extreme examples. You can take a vacant lot in a city and you can place solar panels on the ground at their most optimum angle, and you can surround that with a chain link fence for security, throw up a couple of CCTV cameras, maybe some barbed wire around the top.
Right.
And yes, you've reduced our overall carbon footprint and done a good thing for the environment, but in the bigger picture, maybe you have done a bit of a disservice to the movement, and maybe you've blocked the pathway to future community energy installations when people associate them with how that visual impact on the urban design of their community has been resolved. And the other extreme example would be the same landowner and institutions going to the community through a co-design process, engaging a local artist, lifting the panels off the ground, creating a public park, inviting people in to learn about the technology, and through the process, doing not just accomplishing the first goal, but accomplishing a much broader and long-term goal.
We were at a conference at the Arizona State University maybe about a year and a half ago, and I think the title was Eradicating Poverty Through Energy Innovation. And what was really interesting about that conference is that there were case examples from around the world of installations, renewable energy installations, that worked and those that didn't, and why they did or why they didn't. And really the takeaway was that every community around the world is different, and therefore the energy landscape has to be dealt with differently. And things potentially, most likely, won't be successful if community has not been engaged at some point in the process.
And that part of that community engagement is knowledge transfer and creating a sense of pride and ownership in the final outcome. So the Renaissance Gate, the artwork that resulted from Arden Energy Camp in Pittsburgh, is there now, and everyone in the neighborhood knows that the kids designed and built it. And so it doesn't need a chain link fence with barbed wire around it. And then if you think about installations around the world, as Elizabeth was saying, the inverter breaks one day, and all of a sudden does the whole thing become something that will never work again? Or is someone out there taking care of it? And do they know how to troubleshoot when something changes and goes wrong? And you have to have that institutional knowledge that lives on in the community for these places to work and for the transition to be successful.
Yeah, it's a community, maybe non-capital sort of investment in it as well. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at
geographicalimaginations.org.
I like the fact that, you know, you're, and this again is from your essay, from Powering Places, this idea that, or this proposal that we start to think about and frame the world instead as high carbon world versus low carbon world. And it switches sort of the metric on consumption. Where did that come from? How did the, in your work with this, I could only imagine that this is, you know, maybe it's been a real helpful shift in your own thinking at some point, but then bringing it into all of your projects. This is a, I think, a pretty big change that we wouldn't read in my human geography textbook. No one's talking about that, or at least not yet.
We were doing work in Olorgesailie, Lake Kenya, a couple of years ago, and we, both of us, have always had concerns with terms of first world, third world, developing, yeah, undeveloped. That has never settled well with either of us. And when we were in Kenya, that's when we had the aha moment of high carbon versus low carbon.
Yeah.
And what, how that could switch our value set culturally.
So basically, it also relates to how much First Nations, Indigenous cultures around the world have to teach us if we are to truly transition from a culture of exploitation of nature and consumption to one of stewardship,
yeah,
of nature and conservation of nature. And a culture of stewardship is where we're heading, but we can't get there if we don't listen to the lessons that have been deeply learned by human cultures in the past. And to say that the high carbon world needs to transition to become a low carbon world, and by whatever means necessary to do that, it shows that there are places in this world that have already achieved that. Not to say that that we would need to keep those cultures from aspiring to the levels of comfort in life that that the high carbon world has established through its petrocultures, but that they can leapfrog their way to it through sustainable mechanisms of comfort and luxury, whereby everything is electrified and it's all done so through renewable energy resources, in a similar way as the cell phone leapfrogged communications in,
right,
certain parts of the world, that we have an opportunity to point away by combining ancient technology and current technology to smoothly bridge the gap and maintain those cultures as low carbon at the same time as they quote-unquote develop, but shifting the value set to say that we're the ones here sitting in Seattle, Washington, in a high-carbon world that need to change. It's not those people in faraway places who need to change.
Yeah. So in the world of the conferences and the people that you talk with in your work, are there a lot of people talking about that? Like this, the high carbon world has to look at its consumption in a very, very major way. I mean, is that part of the conversation, or is it again still kind of, you know, looking towards the future of energy? Is it still just thinking about how to engineer it?
You know, it's both, and it's a complicated question because you really are not going to win if your strategy is to get everyone in the United States to stop consuming and start conserving, and the idea of sacrifice is competing against the idea of hedonistic sustainability, where we don't need to sacrifice, we just need to be smarter about the way that we use energy. We need to create the infrastructure that can transition us so that we don't have to go back to an earlier time, pre-industrial time, that we can maintain forward cultural and economic progress, that we can detach GDP from and redefine what that is from carbon emissions. I think that that's a more winning strategy in terms of understanding human nature. We're not all going to immediately stop driving our cars. We need to change the way our cars work.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think it's a complicated conversation.
Yeah. So if knowing the limitations of radio here, at the very least, we introduce the audience to your work and the work of people that, you know, part of your network around the globe, really. Where should people look next? So listeners, should they check out your website? Where would you direct them to if they want to find out more, educate themselves more, or if they have ideas about a proposal, where should they find you?
Well, they can find us at landartgenerator.org, and our email is lagi@landartgenerator.org. And we love engaging with everyone. So if you have children listening and they want to email us, we will respond. We engage with all demographics, as we've chatted about. And we have publications that are out, that those are easy to find online. And if someone wanted to participate in one of our international competitions, we've just launched a competition for Masdar City in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, opened in mid-January. It will be open until mid-May. First place prize is $40,000 U.S., so really it's the largest cash prize we've ever provided.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're really excited. We know we're going to get really terrific ideas that capture the imagination of the world.
Yeah, design our renewable energy future and put a little money in the pocket.
That's a good thing. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to share with us your work, your projects, and encourage us to rethink a little bit our energy future. Thanks to Robert and Elizabeth.
Thank you for the time.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks. So with that, we've come to the end of episode 51. Check us out online, www.geographicalimaginations.org. Stay tuned next month. See you soon. Bye.